Coming up on Tech News Weekly, TikTok's transparency report seems kind of not very transparent. Also, robocalls might be going away thanks to the TRACED Act. No, I doubt it. Amazon's return policy is getting a little more complicated thanks to Kohl's. And battery technology is progressing fast as we enter the 20s. All that more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Tech News Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure that they do by making access and authentication seamless. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 114, recorded Thursday, January 2nd, 2020. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yes, it's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/TNW.
And by YouStudio. YouStudio hosts, manages, and distributes private podcasts and videocasts for businesses. Deliver corporate audio and video content securely to any device in a modern mobile-first experience. Learn more at the letter U, studio.com. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly in the new year.
I want to say the new decade, but there's everybody's online like protesting that.
Every new day is the start of a new decade.
That's true.
Any moment is the start of a new decade.
Okay.
It's all about how you think about it.
Yeah.
It's perception.
That's true.
And this is the show where every week we talk about time math, and also we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Micah Sargent.
And I'm Jason Howell.
We will forever be
Micah Sargent and Jason Howell, even in the 20s. Now we can say the 20s. Isn't that kind of interesting?
Oh, that's weird.
It's the 20s now.
Yeah.
But not like black and white 20s.
It's the early 20s.
It's like the modern
20s. Oh, ooh. Okay, so we had the roaring 20s. What's this? The boring 20s?
Oh, boy. What is this? Maybe it is boring 20s.
Oh, was it raging? Raging. These are the raging 20s. Okay, I was like, I thought they were the... Okay, yeah. We had roaring. Now we've got raging.
Raging. Yeah, I guess we'll find out in 10 years.
That's true. We'll look back on this day and have determined what it actually
is. We'll be like, wow, we had no idea back then.
It certainly wasn't the boring 20s. Oh, boy. So talking about boring, that's my segue that doesn't work at all.
No, that doesn't work. If we were talking about the boring tunnel project of Elon Musk's, that might work. But
yeah.
I don't know that TikTok is like super boring, but I never go to TikTok, so maybe that's because I'm bored of it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what we'll do.
Okay.
Talking about being bored of a thing, I am bored of TikTok. And you are bored of this episode of Tech News Weekly.
Bravo.
But please keep listening. So I found this story interesting. This is the TikTok is that app that I kind of call a social video sharing service. You can go on, you can watch videos that other people share, you can make videos, you can remix other people's videos, you can use parts of their videos with your videos. It's like retweeting videos. It's a video platform.
Kind of Vine-like, although Vine doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it's a little Vine-like. They can be a lot longer if you want them to, but the ones that seem to do well are the ones that are pretty short.
Yeah.
And, you know, TikTok's been in the news recently for kind of being in trouble or being suspicious at the very
least.
Especially in the United States. You know, I can't remember. Oh, it was on iOS today. The U.S. Navy said any government issued phones, no TikTok on those phones. Thank you very much. We've had senators reaching out to TikTok saying, hey, we need to hear more about this company. We're kind of worried about espionage from China. It's, of course, owned by a Chinese-owned company. And they wanted to, you know, make sure that it wasn't going to be a bit of spyware that's sort of being used to spy on our citizens, spy on their citizens, et cetera. And then also claims of policing what content gets shared on the platform. So with the Uyghur protests going on in China, or rather in Hong Kong, there's conversation there as well. So I found it interesting that TikTok has put out a transparency report. This is their first one. And the transparency report, for folks who don't know, this is the way that different companies can say, hey, this is the number of times that the United States government has asked us for user data in order to help with a case of some sort. This is how many times this government has done this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Copyright takedown.
Yeah, copyright. Exactly. All those kinds of things. And TikTok says there have been no takedown requests from China whatsoever. And there have been some in the United States. There have been some in other countries, but apparently, according to the transparency report, China is not listed among the countries in the report.
And the report does say that if it's not on here, then it didn't happen, right?
That's, well, yes. So at least the claim is like, hey, we've got this document, and this shows the takedown reports that have happened.
That have happened.
Yeah.
And if it's not here.
So if it's not here, then it hasn't happened.
China, then we should all assume that that didn't happen, which seems a little strange. And not just takedowns, by the way. It's you know, yes, it is takedowns, but it's also demands like requests for user data,
which
is a large part of the suspicion of TikTok.
Well, I mean, and that's the big thing is anytime, you know, Google puts out these reports, Apple puts out these reports. A lot of time what happens is a judge says, yes, you know, the CIA, the FBI, I don't know which groups, the secret groups with the letters come and they say, hey, judge, I need some information on this user or this set of users because I think that they might be, I don't know, selling drugs, drinking drugs. And so they are trying to get that information for their court case. The judge says, yes, you can subpoena this company. They take that order to the company. The company hands over the data. And then the company can put that in the report at the end of the year to say, this is the number of times that's happened. Every bit of history and what we've seen from China with Google, with Apple, with other companies is like China's so big. It is a big company, or it's a big company. It's a big government. Mm-hmm. And there's, in my opinion, there's no way that it has not done some level of user data requests because it's just it's too big of a government right along with the United States government and with other governments. I think India was also on the list. There's no way that they're not included.
I mean, depends on how you look at it. Right? Some could look at TikTok and think that the entire service is a request for user information.
Ooh.
Depending on how much access the Chinese government has to it.
Okay.
That could be total conspiracy theory, and probably you should probably consider that conspiracy theory. Another possible thing around this that might kind of change things is that in China, TikTok itself isn't necessarily available to most of China.
Right.
What is an app called Douyin. Mm-hmm. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I'm pronouncing it like it's spelled, but I'm probably mispronouncing it. And that is an app, similar service, that does adhere to China's censorship laws.
Okay.
And so maybe what that transparency report on TikTok is saying is, yeah, we haven't gotten any requests from China. And then because in very, very TikTok. Small print, because this app actually isn't in Chinese users' hands. It's this other one called Douyin that we're not talking about in this transparency report because Douyin and TikTok are not the same thing.
Clever.
So maybe it's that.
Okay. I can dig that. I think that seems reasonable.
Either way, feels a little disingenuous.
Yeah. So I don't know how to feel about it, but you can check out the report straight from TikTok as well as the sort of breakdown from The Verge.
Yeah. A lot of people writing about this and no one feeling like there's a whole lot of clarity coming from TikTok or the Chinese government as far as that's concerned.
Crystal cloudy.
Well, shifting gears slightly, robocalls, not RoboCop.
RoboCop.
RoboCop is cool, but robocalls suck.
Does he say, I'll be back in RoboCop? Or
no,
is
that's
that
the Terminator.
Okay.
I'll be back.
What's the difference?
JK,
nerds.
Basically the same thing.
Oh,
you're right.
God,
you're
I've
right.
ruined everything.
RoboCalls, would you say they suck? Like,
oh,
do you like them?
Oh.
They suck. And mostly it seems like they're unstoppable. right? This has been a big year.
Unstoppable, like the Terminator, RoboCop the Terminator.
Perhaps the TRACED Act will help. President Trump just signed into law the TRACED Act after it was approved in both the House and the Senate late last month. This happened on New Year's Eve, so Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and all other things. It was a bipartisan effort to hopefully curb or at least reduce these spam calls and robocallers once and for all. I'll believe it when I see it.
TRACED. Right.
TRACED stands for Telephone Robocall Abuse Criminal Enforcement and Deterrence. I love how they're able to like sandwich these things into.
So
into
they don't put an acronyms. A on the end for ACT.
No.
So it's just.
So it's not TRACEDA?
Yeah, TRACEDA. Yeah.
TRACEDA? it's expected to take about 12 to 18 months for the results of this to finally become visible. Like to the everyday user. Mm-hmm. It requires carriers to identify legitimate and illegitimate callers and then to provide tools to subscribers so that they can block these calls on the carrier level and not charge extra for it.
So there are some companies that are already compliant with this. AT&T has had this. They originally had this technology. I'm an yep. AT&T subscriber. And they originally had this technology, and you had to pay for it. And then not too long ago, they made it free
right.
For the TRACED Act that was going to be coming through.
Yeah, yeah. They had some early work done earlier in the year that
absolutely.
Was kind of moving in this direction, and this is like the next phase.
And you see that a lot with these different companies. Same thing with the California User Protection Privacy Act or whatever it all is, SIPA, that companies kind of hop on board a little bit sooner. But yeah, AT&T Call Protect is what the app is called,
yep.
and it does it on the carrier side. I was going to say, I haven't had to worry about robocalls in ages because I use, even before I had AT&T Call Protect, I used an app called RoboKiller.
And pretty effective?
Oh, 100% effective.
Wow.
And what's okay. great is it doesn't just work for robocalls. It can also work for telemarketers and things like that.
Yeah.
And I don't suggest and I don't support the idea of being mean to telemarketers, but I don't necessarily hate the idea of sort of wasting their time as they're wasting yours. And so with the RoboKiller, you can choose different voicemail answers. And so you can have Morgan Freeman talking to them and just like, oh, yeah.
But okay. Can you have the Terminator?
I should look.
Yeah.
I should look and see if the Terminator's on there.
I'll call back. Bigger penalties, up to $10,000 per call.
Whoa.
Per call. So that could add up.
You don't want
to Gives the
pay
government
that.
More enforcement tools, which kind of paves the way for Justice Department prosecution, lengthens the statute of limitations. All good things, of course. Similar to what you were talking about on the Pixel, there's a call screening capability baked into the Pixel. You can also go into the dialer and basically hide, like Google on its side will identify spam callers and hide them from you. The calls still kind of go through, so like I'll find out that suddenly that I have a voicemail, but I never heard it. It didn't bother me.
Mm.
So it's kind of nice from that perspective. At the same time, it also alerts them that there's actually a person on the other end of this line, and sometimes you don't want that. So I don't know how these rules are going to affect that, because sometimes even that's valuable information for some of these robocallers,
right.
just knowing that someone is there. According to a UMail report, 58.5 billion robocalls in 2019. That's up from 48 billion last year. And back in 2016, it was $29 billion. So, I mean, that curve continues to skyrocket. It amounts to around 164.4 calls per person, according to the report that was affected. So
that's just, it's ridiculous.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Think about the amount of energy, the amount of time, all of these data points of 58.5 billion robocalls.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully that makes a change, because they are the scourge.
I'm going to make a change.
Mike is going to get warmed up for his solo
coming
up. But actually, what's coming up is Amazon.
Oh.
We're going to talk about how Amazon is changing how it handles returns on some items. I wasn't even aware of this. Ray Wong is going to join us. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. We all know how a VPN protects your privacy and your security online, but did you know that it can take your TV watching to the next level? can unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. You can use ExpressVPN to binge on Doctor Who or Star Trek on the UK Netflix. You can do that. It's simple. You just fire up the ExpressVPN app, change your location to the UK, refresh Netflix, and that's it. It works. ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. So just think about all the Netflix libraries that you can go through, because they do have different libraries for different locales. If you love anime, use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away. Let's see what we did there. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there. I love ExpressVPN. I use it, and you can use it too to watch shows. It's super fast, right? And you don't want that lag. You don't want that slowdown when you're watching something over a VPN. ExpressVPN, you won't get that. There's never any buffering or lag, and you can stream in HD, no problem. ExpressVPN is also compatible with all your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, and more. So you can watch what you want on the go or on the big screen, wherever you like. And it's just an invaluable tool. Not to mention, great to have if you're ever connecting to public Wi-Fi. You know, it also has all of the security benefits that we aren't really covering here, because you know about those security benefits. But this is one new way that you can ExpressVPN that you should know about. If you visit our special link right now, that's expressvpn.com/TNW, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. So you can support this show, watch what you want, and protect yourself all at the same time at expressvpn.com/TNW.
So it has just been the gift-giving holiday season.
It has.
You know, folks are giving gifts, getting gifts, and I don't know about you, but a lot of those gifts for me kind of came from Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Know all about that.
Yep. Got that Amazon gift receipt, and sometimes you might not like what you got, or the person that you gave the gift to doesn't like what they got. They go online, they want to make a return, and they have to go to Kohl's?
Yeah. I wasn't aware of this. Kind of an interesting change.
I have no idea what's going on, but luckily we have Ray Wong here from Input to tell us all about it. Welcome, Ray.
Hello.
Hello. How's it going? It's going well. So
Happy New Year, guys.
Oh, Happy New Year to you too.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So tell us all about Amazon and Kohl's being buddy-buddy. What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of figured this out as a regular customer. You know, I want to return something, and I went online to my orders and my account and tried to return something, and it turns out they're trying to kick me to Kohl's. And I think that's kind of problematic, just because, you know, you may not be near a Kohl's. It may be a trek out for you. It may be inconvenient. The whole point of Amazon is to buy online, shop online, and easy returns. And they promote this pretty heavily. You know, they added millions of items this holiday shopping season to their free returns. And now they're asking us to kind of go to Kohl's. Now, they started this program as a pilot program in 2018. And they expanded it to over 1,000 Kohl's stores in the middle of this year. And I don't think a lot of people are aware that this is the first option for a free return. And it's kind of why I wrote this little opinion piece, because I don't think a lot of people realize this. And for some people, it may be convenient that going to Kohl's is, you know, it's a free return. It's an easy trip. But like for me, I live in New York City, and not to be like, you know, single myself out or anything, but like millions of people live in New York City, and there isn't a Kohl's within, you know, a subway ride, you know? So not very convenient.
Yeah. So this was interesting to me. In your report, you kind of talk about how you very rarely make returns, and I kind of fall into
very,
that too.
Right.
Yeah, me too.
It's rare that that happens, right?
What's that?
I was just saying, yeah, I was confirming, yeah, that it's rare that that happens, that you make a return. So whenever it does, right, you're kind of hoping right that it's going to go quickly.
So, right. So previously I'd make a return, and Amazon would give you a free label that you can print out, tape to your package, and then drop off your return item to a UPS store or a UPS drop-off box. Now they've kind of complicated things with multiple options. And so your first option is most likely going to be to bring it to a Kohl's. Your second option is going to be bring it to a UPS store and let the customer rep pack and ship your item. And both those are free. But it's weird to me and very bizarre that if I want to print out my own label, pack it all myself at my own convenience, drop it off at a store, and not have to wait in any lines, deal with any customer reps, really, they charge you money for that. And I really want to know why. And so in my probe, I kind of came to the conclusion that maybe, if I'm being an optimist here, maybe Amazon is trying to discourage returns by, you know, making it a little bit more inconvenient, a little bit of hassle, but that's kind of a stretch, you know? Amazon is a massive corporation. They, again, advertise free returns on millions of items, and I don't think that they're genuinely trying to discourage that in such an indirect way.
In your time looking into this, like, where did Kohl's come from in all of this? Like, it seemed kind of random to me that suddenly it's like, oh, Amazon's got this relationship with Kohl's for returns.
I mean, it's a good partnership for Kohl's, first of all, because, sure, I mean, they've got dwindling foot traffic, and this gets a lot more people into their stores. You know, you're in there, you're making a return, and they also give you a coupon, I think up to 20 or 25% off an in-store purchase. And so they said that, you know, Kohl's said that they're getting a lot of younger people into their stores. And, you know, young people are definitely not shopping at Kohl's or TJ Maxx or, you know, any of these department stores that are no longer, you know, convenient for them. And so they're trying to get more foot traffic into their stores. And Amazon is spinning this as they're utilizing Amazon's infrastructure. So, you know, Amazon is handling all the returns. I mean, Kohl's is handling all the returns. And so they don't have to invest in as much, you know, customer service in their warehouses. And, you know, they can kind of double up on Kohl's network. And maybe it actually helps reduce, you know, their carbon footprint and, you know, reduces the amount of transportation that they have to use, the coal, you know, all these things. When you think about the amount of returns that must be processed by Amazon every day, it's got to be insane, you know? And they're just stored in these warehouses, all your items, and most of them actually go unsold. They're not resold again as refurbished products, and they're just like open box or wrong sizes. And Amazon has a couple of options. They can try to resell them, which is very rare, or they leave it in this warehouse where it's just sitting there. They can't sell it, or they can kind of, you know, destroy it. And I think in Europe, there was a new law that just came into play that is barring Amazon from destroying all these return products. And, you know, by 2023, I believe, they have to find another solution. So, you know, whether that's working with another third party vendor to try to resell these items, maybe in more emerging markets for less, there's a big return problem right now that honestly Amazon has helped create, you know, and they have a responsibility right now to try to find a solution to fix it. And I don't think Kohl's is necessarily the only solution. I think more can be done. And that's kind of the gist of my story is, I think Amazon needs to take more responsibility for this. And it can't just be Kohl's, you know? It needs to be, maybe it's expanding it to more department stores, other department stores, Sears, I don't know, JCPenney, TJ Maxx, and also leveraging their existing infrastructure, which is Whole Foods, you know? They have a lot of these Amazon lockers, Whole Foods. Sure, there aren't as many Whole Foods stores. There are only 479 Whole Foods in the U.S. compared to over, I think, 1,150 Kohl's. But in certain areas, they need to, like, use the data that they have and provide a solution that makes sense. So in New York City, where I live, there are tons of Whole Foods, you know? There are more Whole Foods in Manhattan than there are Kohl's, which is zero, you know? So, like, how does Amazon, a massive corporation that knows so much about its Prime members, has all of our shipping information, not know that this is not the best solution for me?
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's where your thought that maybe they're discouraging returns comes into play for sure. Whenever you say, okay, you've got all this information, you know what's available to me and what's not, that I can't make those returns at a place that's closer to me. Now, you did include a little bit of a, hack, we'll say,
for a
way to kind of circumvent these rules. So what's going on there, and why does it make you a liar?
Right. So if you choose, when you make a return on Amazon, it gives you a list of options, and the options tell you, you know, is it the wrong size? You know, is it, basically they're trying to determine if it's their fault, if it was their error, or it was my error, the customer's error. And if it's the customer's error and wasn't Amazon's fault, then they try to charge you for this UPS drop off. So on screen right now, you can see that it cost me $7.26 to pack it myself, print my own label. I'm taking care of everything. Mm-hmm. And they want to charge me for that versus making me go to a store, which is inconveniencing me and millions of customers, and having someone else do all the work, or going to a Kohl's, waiting in line, having someone else process it. And the hack is, you basically have to lie. You have to choose a reason that makes it seem like it's Amazon's fault. Now, I don't want to do that. I rarely do that because I rarely make returns. But like, it seems egregious that I and millions of other paying Prime members, we pay $120 per year, we pay for this service, and we can't get free returns. Like, that makes no sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can say it's the difference between this is my fault or the third party seller's fault versus this is Amazon's fault. And if it is Amazon's fault in some way, like a bad description for the product, or something like that, then you can get the non-paying UPS drop-off.
So the problem is, I think there needs to be more that can be done. Mm-hmm. Amazon should be more direct with customers, especially if this is an indirect way to discourage people from making returns. Now, I want to believe that it is, right? And I think we all want to believe that. You know, I think a lot of people want to be more environmentally friendly. We don't want land waste. We don't want e-waste. And if Amazon was more transparent about this, then, you know, I think customers would make better decisions, you know, and decide whether they actually want to go to a store or, you know, ship it out. Because, you know, according to the data, it costs almost twice as much money to ship a product for a return than it does to go in store and return it. Mm. So I think it's about average is like $3 to return something in store versus $6 to, you know, transport it and ship it back to a warehouse, get processed and all that stuff. So it does save Amazon money if they can get customers into stores to return their goods. But again, it's a bad user experience, you know, and Amazon built its entire empire on this ease of use, fast shipping, you know, and fast and easy returns that they need to figure a solution that is better than this, right? You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Plus, I feel kind of weird about hey, if you come into the store, we'll give you 25% off.
Come on.
We know you're going to like it.
Some clothes for you.
We got some candy here. Very weird.
It's very odd. And again, I don't think a lot of people are aware of this. It's a new policy that came into place in the middle of this year, or middle of last year, I should say. And, you know, I think a lot of people are waking up post-Christmas, post-holiday season, you know, today is what, the 2nd, and it's unofficially the National Returns Day. And a lot of people are realizing, oh my God, what the heck is this Kohl's policy? You know? And like me, I found that out a couple weeks ago. And so I decided to write this editorial just because I think it's kind of as a PSA, you know, I think a lot of people are not aware of this. And Amazon and Kohl's and a lot of people are spinning this as like, you know, this is great because, you know, it's so easy, just go to a Kohl's. But what if you don't live near a Kohl's? What if you actually have to spend a lot of time going to a Kohl's, waiting in line for a person to process it? Then what do you do? How is that a better experience than just, you know, letting me print it out for free, the label, and dropping it off at a UPS drop-off box, which there are many, or a UPS store at my own convenience, you know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ray Wong, we thank you so much for joining us today, for sharing this PSA. If folks want to follow you online and see all of the cool content you're putting out, where can they do so?
First of all, definitely check out inputmag.com. We're a new tech site that we just launched a couple weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago. And we've got big things in 2020. So lots of really awesome, cool content and editorial like that on inputmag.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Ray Wongi. That's R-A-Y-W-O-N-G with a Y at the end. And yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Ray.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, guys.
Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Coming up, we are going to take a look at the current state of batteries and the future we can look forward to. Which reminds me, it's time to charge the T&W battery.
Okay, I'll plug it in.
All right, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by U-Studio. It's safe to say you like staying informed through shows just like ours, and, well, you're not alone. 44% of Americans turn to podcasts for their news and information. So it's no wonder that businesses want to leverage this medium for their workforces. U-Studio hosts, manages, and distributes private podcasts and videocasts for businesses. It's fully customizable with your company's logo and colors. It lets your organization deliver confidential information securely to your employees, remote workforces, customers, and partners. And studies show that audio and video formats are up to 700% more effective than text, since email updates are so easy to miss or ignore. Yeah, I ignore a lot of emails. U-Studio can be implemented in hours, not months, and it provides detailed analytics. You can know who's engaging with what, when, and how often. Think of all the ways your company could utilize a private podcast or videocast with U-Studio. You can share weekly messages from the CEO. You can onboard remote workforces. You can spread company news on product updates and so much more. The other great thing about U-Studio is its privacy and security. You can ensure your confidential business information is never discoverable online. Quickly authenticate users using SSO or other authentication protocols. Restrict access by department, seniority, and location. And it can be downloaded and listened to on demand so your users can make the most of that time that usually gets lost during commuting or traveling. Join companies like Salesforce, like Nike, and like Dell, who trust U-Studio to power their private podcasts. Go to ustudio.com today to request your free trial or a personalized demo. And be sure to mention you heard about it from Tech News Weekly. That's the letter U, studio.com.
So the last decade has seen monumental progress in the world of technology, no doubt. And one constant thread that runs through so many of the decade's success stories is something I feel like we kind of take for granted at this point. That's batteries. Joining us to talk about how far battery tech has come and maybe more importantly, where it's headed in the 20s is Pippa Stevens from CNBC. Welcome to the show, Pippa.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
It is awesome to get you on today. So you wrote an excellent article here that really just kind of details kind of the arc of the last 10 years of battery technology and where it's headed. You break it down really well throughout. So I'm happy to get you on so we can kind of pick this apart a little bit. Let's start by looking backwards a little bit. We're now 2 days removed from the tens. Can we call it the tens now?
Sure.
I feel like we can because we can call the 2020s the 20s. But we're a few days removed from the last decade. What are some of battery tech's biggest wins from the last decade? And what kind of enabled that progress that wasn't there prior?
Yeah, absolutely. So first and foremost, battery technology in its simplest form dates back 2 centuries to 1799. So they've been around for a very long time, but kind of throughout history, different mixes have been used to make the most efficient, the most powerful batteries with different chemicals and different underlying materials. So really in the past 10 years, what's happened is that this demand for this lithium ion battery has really grown so exponentially that it achieved an economy of scale, making it cheaper and more viable for a vast array of devices. So while at the beginning of the decade, it was in iPhones and all over the place, now it's really shifted to more larger scale to things like cars and then energy storage on a utility level. So since 1991, when Sony first commercialized the lithium ion battery, there's been constant improvements along the way. But really, you know, very small steps have had measurable impacts in terms of efficiency and rechargeability, which is very, very important. So once you can get batteries to be more efficient with the charge and discharge process, then you can really scale them to larger and wider uses.
and we're super locked into this lithium ion kind of approach with batteries right now. Do you, like, are there emerging battery technologies around the corner that might open things up in ways that are kind of hard to understand? Because I know when you're talking about like mobile phones, you know, often it comes down to battery performance and, you know, people want slimmer, smaller phones, mm-hmm. but then that goes counter to the fact that they also want a battery that lasts all day long and multiple days. Yeah. And I think the limiting factor there is, well, lithium ion is really great for certain things, but there's only so much that science can do to like shrink that down and still have the longevity. Is there emerging battery technology that could kind of change the way the scales are tipping right now?
Yeah, so typically when you try and fiddle with one element of the battery, you end up, you know, it costs you in another area of the battery. So we talk about both power and energy, and power is how much you can get out immediately, and then energy is how much you can hold over a period of time. So lithium ion, which in and of itself is a catch-all phrase because there are many different types of lithium ion batteries. It's really great for, you know, the portability and kind of the quick charge that we need for things like cell phones. But it's not great on the utility and on the bigger scale. And right now it's the best we have, but there are certainly other areas, other types of batteries that are being researched and developed. So that includes things like flow batteries, which don't have that same power of the lithium ion battery, but it's much greater on the energy scale. So it can hold storage for, you know, multiple hours, weeks, potentially even months. And then there's things like solid state batteries. So one of the problems with lithium ion batteries, and we saw that with the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 phone that, you know, exploded, and there were videos of them on planes and stuff. Mm-hmm. Problem with that is that there can be reactions in some of the more common lithium ion batteries with the electrolyte. So solid state batteries are trying to get away from that. And then just, you know, in terms of higher power batteries, people are always looking into that. And also the problem with the lithium ion is that the underlying raw materials are very expensive. And then there's also issues with things like cobalt. You know, about 50% of cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. So there's a lot of issues with how it's extracted, you know, things like human rights violations. Mm. So scientists are always looking for ways to get away from our dependence on lithium ion. But it just so happens that it's so well suited for the uses that we have today that it's hard to get anything else up to that scale.
Yeah. So what's interesting to me when I look back on the last decade is just how differently battery technology has kind of defined the decade in ways that prior to the 2010s would have felt like science fiction. For example, Tesla is a very, very much a household name now, leading the way on electric vehicles. The industry as a whole seems to be slowly moving in that direction. Of course, there was the electric car, you know, kind of movement that happened prior to Tesla. That didn't really go so far for a number of reasons. But now we're back, and it seems like, you know, this is just going to move forward. This is the new direction, the way that car companies are headed now. What can those car companies learn from Tesla? What is Tesla doing right now as they try to double down on electric vehicles in the 20s?
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of the decade, I think, you know, Tesla was very much a novelty and no one really thought that it could work given how expensive it is to manufacture these lithium ion batteries. But as their prices have come down, they've fallen 85% since 2010. And it coupled with the shift in terms of consumer demand. And now that, you know, there's a lot more priority being placed on the climate crisis than there was in 2010. So, you know, car makers, where once they thought, okay, like Elon Musk, he's not really going to make his Tesla car company viable, they were left scrambling to catch up. So basically all automakers now have either an 100% battery electric vehicle or at least some sort of hybrid in the process. I think one of the reasons why Tesla has really been able to win is, first of all, they have the best battery technology. So they haven't confirmed it, but most analysts speculate that they've brought their costs below $100 per kilowatt hour for their battery pack, which means they're leading the way. And then also, they have been uniquely focused on 100% vehicles since they began, since their 2008 Roadster. So they don't have to, you know, deal with different manufacturing, different supply chains based on whether or not they're internal combustion engines or hybrids or battery electric. And so that's really helped them get all of their costs down. You know, they have their big gigafactory in Sparks, Nevada, which then centralizes their production and makes it very close to their distribution locations. And so bringing that all under one house has really helped them bring those very high raw materials, very high fixed costs down. And then finally, they also have their power wall and their utility grade storage options. So that also allows them to scale the fixed costs, because any battery cells that aren't used for electric vehicles can then be used for their home storage or utility scale storage offerings.
Yeah, and I think the battery storage that you're talking about there is a critical component as we move forward as well. You know, a large part of what you write about is kind of this shifting infrastructure and the utility companies, and how, you know, solar and wind, all this power, it's much more achievable to get this. But the problem is, of course, you need to be able to store that energy somehow. Tesla, of course, SolarCity, you know, their efforts on working on the battery wall, and other companies, we're going to see a lot more of this. What kind of effect is this going to have for the everyday energy consumer as we move forward?
So as these lithium ion batteries have reached economies of scale, it means that the prices have now come down so much that they can be used for things like home storage and utility scale storage. So it's made the consumer electronics demand that has pushed down these prices has made it feasible. So that's kind of the next frontier. So as you said, wind and solar are gaining a huge amount of traction, and, you know, they're set to be 50% of our energy by 2050. But the problem is that they're intermittent power sources. So when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing, then you have that problem where you can't store any of that electricity. Mm-hmm. So the next frontier really for the batteries and for moving away from a fossil fuel dependent society is for these utility scale batteries to be developed and then deployed more frequently and across the grid as a whole.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to for me personally, for the time when we finally do get solar on our house, mm-hmm. and being enticed in the direction with a lowering cost of the power stores to be able to have the ability to implement that. Like, it seems like that's far away, but probably going to happen sometime, at least in our household.
But also, I mean, you see just most recently from the PG&E, from cutting off the power in California.
Absolutely.
I mean, Sunrun is the largest residential solar offering in the country. And so their Brightbox offering then combines the solar panels with home storage. And so, you know, as the grid gets overloaded and as there are these, you know, dangers from fires or trees falling on power lines or whatever it is, if you have that ability to have a battery powered with electricity in your house, then you're able to hold over until the grid gets back up and running.
Yeah. Oh, and so invaluable in that regard. Finally, what are Wall Street analysts saying about this as we move forward? What are they saying about their investments in the battery supply chain? Do they see a shift in how these investments are made as we enter the next decade?
Well, there's no shortage of money going into this space because, I mean, it's the key ingredient to get us away from, you know, nat gas and coal.
Yeah.
But it's very challenging. As with any kind of new-ish technology, it's hyper, hyper competitive. I spoke to one person who compared it to, you know, the chip makers and DRAM in the 90s. And, you know, you have all these companies vying for market share and vying to get their costs down and produce the most efficient batteries. And then you also have government subsidies, which play a huge role in encouraging battery developments and, you know, are a huge role for Tesla and for consumers who opt into solar panels. And so that's a huge player as well. And then there are some questions that once those subsidies and incentives go away, you know, what's left? Like, how are these companies, you know, going to make it work given their very high costs? But there are many opportunities. So the battery supply chain is vast. So, you know, you have everything from the lithium miners, like a company called Albemarle, to the autos, you know, to the home energy storage. And then you have companies like NextEra Energy, which are really focusing on that utility scale and building that out. And then once those batteries are capable of storing more energy, then, you know, a lot of Wall Street analysts say that that will also increase then our shift towards renewable power. So, you know, the companies that manufacture solar panels and wind turbines are set to benefit. And then as the grid changes to a microgrid construction, there'll have to be a lot of companies that come out with battery management systems. So it will be a whole new grid where, unlike today, when you can constantly see your supply and demand because you're providing power instantaneously, when you have kind of some power stored and then you're trying to figure out, you know, what ratio you're going to use of incoming power versus your stored energy, there's going to have to be a ton of technology that monitors that. So then there are a bunch of battery management systems and semiconductor names that are set to benefit. So there's really no shortage of ways to kind of tangentially play the upswing in battery investment without actually focusing on just the pure play battery makers, which is a hyper-competitive field.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Pippa, this is all fascinating stuff. I highly encourage everybody to learn a little bit more about kind of where we're headed with battery technology. Pippa Stevens' article is on CNBC. Pippa, thank you so much for joining us today. It was great to have
you.
Thank you. We appreciate your work. We'll talk to you soon. All right, and that is it.
We have
reached the end of the 2020s. Next episode, 2021. No,
wait,
not true.
That
not
doesn't
true.
Make sense.
No, it doesn't make
We've
any sense.
We've reached the end of the 2020s, and it's got to be 2030.
Oh, that's true.
For the
that's
next
true.
Episode.
The next episode will be the next decade. But no, that is not true. Our next episode will be next week. We publish every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. We don't care the decade. It's on a Thursday going forward, and that's all there is to it.
How it works.
That's where you can go to subscribe to the show in audio and video formats.
You can, of course, be a part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
Yeah.
And follow us on social media at Twit on Twitter, at twit.tv on Instagram, and as long as it still sticks around, at Twit Talk on TikTok. If you want to tweet at me.
Once I start hearing the T's, I can't unhear them.
You can do so at Micah Sargent. I'm on all the social things at Micah Sargent. What about you, Jason?
I'm at Jason Howell on some things, that Jason Howell on other things, basically Jason Howell. But there are other Jason Howells, so just search for the tall Jason Howell. Although I'm always sitting, so you might not know whether I'm tall. It's confusing out there on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I try my best, all right? Thanks to everyone who helps us do the show each and every week. John, Burke, John, helping out today. And we do appreciate your help with the show. And we appreciate you watching this decade and beyond on Tech News Weekly. We'll see you next week. Bye, everybody.
Oh, yeah.